Hey, Greg, can you come over here?
What is it, Kion?
Can you see how close is the tungsten to the puddle?
What on earth are you doing?
Well, I'm trying to learn TIG welding. Marco Rubio has made me see that my career path as a philosopher is totally useless, and I'm never going to make any money or contribute meaningfully to society, but welders do.
Should all that smoke be coming out?
No, see, that's my problem. When I add rod, I risk contaminating the tungsten. But as Nietzsche said, we can destroy only as creators.
That aluminum socket, doesn't look right.
The only thing wrong was that the electrode was recessed back in the cup, but once I extended it out about 3/8 of an inch, everything was fine. But what does fine mean? Judgment of any system exists in an irrational or metaphysical or at least epistemological contradiction to an abstract empirical concept such as being or to be or to occur in the thing itself or of the thing itself.
So what does that mean?
It means that I'm also changing to a helium-argon mix in this arc weld. Lao Tzu says that if you realize that all things change, there's nothing you'll try to hold on to. If you're not afraid of dying, there's nothing you cannot achieve.
Voltaire said, the safest course is to do nothing against one's conscience. With this secret, we can enjoy life and have no fear from death.
Yeah, but did you ever see Voltaire's welding? Once in Brussels, he tried to show Lord Chesterfield the lay wire technique in a big chunk of 4140 steel, but he couldn't hold a tight arc. It was crap welding.
Kion, are you sure you're not rushing into this welding thing without giving philosophy a fair chance?
Greg, it's over. Once upon a time, there were public philosophers who had all-wheel drive vehicles with flashing yellow lights. They wore one-piece uniforms, and they went wherever philosophy was needed. But the whole profession has priced itself out of the market. Now, if you don't mind, I've got a very tricky stainless-to-carbon weld ahead of me. Listen to this show while I do it. And now, the guy who convinced Immanuel Kant to become a certified pharmacy technician, Colin McEnroe.
What I said to him was, Manny, which is what we call him, I said, Manny, you're a great philosopher. The bottom could fall out of this any day, and it's good to have a backup. Pack a parachute. Become a pharmacy technician. And that is, of course, something we learned last night from Marco Rubio, that we need more welders, fewer philosophers, that welders make more money. This turns out not actually to be true. Not that we begrudge welders any penny that they get for their hard work. Just to write that introduction, I had to learn a lot about welding, and it's complicated. And then last night, not only did Mark, you're going to think that we threw this show together as a result of last night's Republican debate, when in fact, I promise you, we have been planning this show for a couple of weeks now. Last night, as if to kick the philosopher when he was already down on the ground, Ted Cruz then started complaining about philosopher kings. He was referring to the Fed, a place I don't necessarily associate with philosophers or philosophy. But anyway, philosophers had a bad night last night. They're going to have a good night today. We're going to talk about, in fact, what kind of contribution of philosophers and philosophy can make to the public debate and to the public sphere. To do this, we're going to talk to Shelley Kagan, the Clark Professor of Philosophy at Yale University. He's the author of Death, a book which is used to teach the philosophical issues surrounding death and dying. His online course has, I'm told, elevated him in China to the status of a Beatle, like the musical kind, I mean. Like he's a rock star over there. And Shelley also, I should say, is one of the reasons we're doing this show, because he and I were on a podcast recently where he sort of said this. He sort of said, well, why? It's just sort of interesting that the average American could not name a philosopher, a living philosopher. You know, why aren't they a bigger part of public debates? And so also joining us, Michael Lynch, a frequent guest on this show, professor of philosophy at the University of Connecticut. He's the author of In Praise of Reason, Why Rationality Matters for Democracy. Lita Maxwell is with us, associate professor of political science and teacher of political philosophy at Trinity College in Hartford. She's the author of Public Trials, Burke, Zola, Arendt, and the Politics of Lost Causes. Let me say also that as we go along here, you may have some ideas too. Maybe you've got things you'd like to ask a philosopher. I actually feel like Ask a Philosopher could take off as a big podcast with just the current cast that we have. I'll bow away and they'll achieve great glory. So we can sort of try this out today as we go along here. If there's, and then not some little conundrum in your personal life, because Not that we're not interested in your personal life, but for today's purposes, we're not. But, you know, if there's some giant question in the public sphere that you'd like to hear a philosophical breakdown of, give us a call, 860-275-7266, 860-275-7266, go online or go online and tweet at us at WNPR Colin. So, Shelley, I'm going to begin with you. I want to hear from all of the guests about this, but I guess one beginning question would be, is this really what philosophy is for? In other words, is philosophy supposed to, and philosophers, supposed to help us, the common ruck, decide public questions on a real-time basis?
Well, I wouldn't say that's the only purpose of doing philosophy. I mean, philosophy, like other subjects, has different things it can contribute and different purposes to which it's put. But it is certainly the case that philosophers have always been engaged with public debates. And going back to Plato and Aristotle, they had views about how society should be structured and what sorts of problems they were facing in their lives. And they were attempting to think about how they could make things better. And so this is certainly an aspect of philosophy that's always been there.
And so, Lita, as you teach political philosophy at Trinity College, are you teaching frequently current events, or are you delving back into questions that are maybe a little bit more settled and easier to dissect for that reason?
I do a mix of things. So we certainly teach Plato and we certainly teach Locke. But I often look at those in the context of contemporary issues such as mass incarceration or, neoliberalism, economic inequality. So I think that political theory has a lot to offer in terms of illuminating contemporary problems in new ways.
You know, and Michael, this is something I think you and I have talked about for a while, that I know it's something that you're interested in, that we're a nation that's very good at having arguments, and we've kind of built up an industry for arguments and sort of loud places for loud arguments to happen on cable news, on talk shows, lots of other places. We're not necessarily a nation that has had much of an interest in acquiring a toolbox that would go along with this, that would make an argument something other than my opinion is right, your opinion is wrong, what I'm saying is true, what you're saying is false. So what is, from a philosopher's point of view, what's the rest of that toolbox? I realize that that's a four-hour answer, but give me the 60-second one.
Well, I think you're right that one of the things that is sometimes can be frustrating for someone who wants people to have a shared toolbox by which to discuss interesting issues of a political nature is that we often find that people either don't have that toolbox or aren't really interested in it, or, and perhaps this is itself it is a philosophical question, might have different toolboxes, that is, have different standards of argumentation, have different standards of rationality. I mean, that's one of the things right there that philosophers can sort of contribute to a political discussion, is that very point that you were just making. It itself unfolds into a philosophical discussion about what we call epistemology, that is, the ways and methods for knowing about the world. People have different ways and methods, and some of our disagreements are actually disagreements about that.
Right, and we should, I mean, obviously it's very simplistic to talk about philosophy as though one big bulwarky monolithic thing, and each one of you is probably an ist of some kind. I don't know what kind of, I at one point knew what kind of ist Shelley was because it came up on the Unorthodox show, but so that's an important part of this. But Shelley, let me also push back at your original contention, because I mean, I think some people might say, well, it's not so much that philosophers aren't welcome in the public sphere or that nobody wants them to be on the public part of the public debate, or that nobody wants them on the Ed Schultz show, if that still exists, so much as philosophers backed away from us. Martha Nussbaum might be the most famous philosopher here. Maybe there's somebody I'm not thinking of, but she doesn't tweet, you know. she's maybe not that. I mean, the philosophers became very interested in hyper-academic subjects that really didn't necessarily lend themselves to the public sphere. They backed away, and they did intellectually kind of price themselves out of the market. How would you react to that?
Well, it's certainly true that a lot of philosophy is highly technical and not easily picked up by an outsider. It takes internal specialist knowledge. That's always been true of philosophy. I mean, Aristotle has works in logic and metaphysics that not just an outsider would have difficulty understanding, but I, as a specialist, have difficulty understanding. But at the same time, it's also the case that throughout the history of philosophy, and I think up into the current day, philosophers are concerned with issues of a public moment, public interest, and continue to write on things in ways that are accessible to an intelligent, concerned individual, if only they were to try to pick these things up, or if only more people followed your lead and invited us on to the shows.
I'm curious also. I'm curious also, Shelley, I'll come right back to you, Michael. One does hear about your prominence in China. You know, the minute the Shelley Kagan plane lands, Chinese people run up, they pick the plane up, they take it to other cities along with Shelley. But, I mean, no, clearly there's a tremendous appetite in China for your work. Does that mean that China is more poised, that the Chinese media consumers and academia consumers are more poised to incorporate philosophy into their lives?
My fame, bizarre as it is to say, I suppose it's true. My fame in China and in South Korea, I think the explanation there is that the kind of exposure to independent critical thinking that is much more typical in America and the West, that's less typical in the East. And so there's a real hunger for exploring the kinds of questions that philosophy in particular tends to explore. And I think that goes some distance towards explaining why some of this stuff is better received. Michael Sandel, political philosopher at Harvard, another, I think, candidate for a public intellectual philosopher. Michael Sandel is also hugely big in South Korea and in China. And so it's partly a matter of there's a hunger for this kind of thinking there that you either don't have here, or maybe just the desire gets satisfied by some exposure in college along the way, but no need to have a lot of it.
Michael, what were you going to say?
I was just going to add that Shelley's exactly right that philosophers have always been technically oriented or in some of their work. But, you know, one and the same philosopher can both be interested in technical. Bertrand Russell is a good example, one of the greatest mathematical logicians of the 20th century or almost any century, but was also somebody who throughout his career was interested in applying lessons that he believed he learned in thinking about philosophy of language and epistemology to more broader questions of broader interest. So I don't think it really sort of depends on the person in question whether they think they can combine these technical interests with more broad-minded political interests.
So I want to sort of walk through a few sort of cases in point. A few of them are ones that you're very well prepared to talk about, and some of them are going to come right out of the blue at you. This will be the latter case with the first one here, Lita. I was listening to Tom Ashbrook today, who the host of On Point on public radio, and in his second hour, I think it was, he was having this really interesting conversation about the value or lack thereof of citizenship in nation states. And what he was exploring with a whole bunch of people, I don't think any of them were philosophers, but maybe I'm wrong, but maybe there was a political philosopher somewhere in the mix. I kind of tuned in late. But the question is, you know, what's the value of being a citizen of Ireland or Pakistan or the United States or Canada, as opposed to being a citizen of the world? If you had a world passport, if your primary identification was with the world, as opposed to your little nation state, you know, maybe you'd be more interested in issues of climate change and human rights and things like that. And if one nation state were not pitted against another, and the interest of the citizens implicitly also pitted against one another, maybe the world would be a better place. I assume that is a question of political philosophy. How does somebody like you begin unpacking it?
Well, I would say two things. The first thing is that when you talk about being a citizen of the world, it's a pretty abstract concept. Mm. And I don't know what the world would look like as one organized political entity. But my suspicion is that even if you had an organized world kind of citizenship organization, underneath that, it would still be organized communities who were actually enforcing rights or not enforcing rights. And this is a famous argument, you know, made by others in terms of problems of statelessness following World War II, particularly Hannah Arendt, that, you know, attempting to enforce human rights is a good thing, but it ignores that it's often really concrete practices of citizenship and having membership in a particular organization that results in you achieving what rights are supposed to achieve. And she talks about how stateless people after World War II, you know, all they had was their humanity, and that meant that they had nothing. So I think that citizenship in a national organization is actually crucial to, you know, allowing citizens to achieve what rights are supposed to achieve, equality, freedom, social goods, et cetera.
I don't know. Michael, you want to push back against that or?
No, I think I actually think that's heading in the right direction. I think the thing that really, for me, that really is fascinating about your remark is it brings out this the fact in which Shelley's original comment is exactly on target, actually, that issues about, you know, if we're all worried about the global refugee crisis, right? And we're all worried about the immigration here in this country. The question of rights always comes up in that context. Well, that's a there are a bunch of philosophical questions. There are economic questions, political questions about rights too. But an essential one is, well, are there rights? And are there rights independent of states? And if there are rights independent of states, what secures those rights? I mean, that's a fundamental and very, very difficult philosophical question. And that's the answers that various philosophers have to those questions can inform and do inform, whether people know it or not, various types of policies out there on these questions.
And to look at the same question from the other side, we take for granted the world, the contemporary world setup, where we have these separate nation states with very sharp borders, and it's taken for granted that each country has a kind of autonomy, that it gets to control who gets to come in, who doesn't get to come in. But this is, from a historical point of view, it's a relatively recent development. And philosophically, it's just not obvious what its justification is. And so one of the things that, in principle, we could be doing is thinking about what are the rights of nations to control who comes in, who doesn't come in. If we just take the contemporary setup for granted, then we're not really asking ourselves, is it justified or not?
All right. Let me just also say, I think some people would listen in to the conversation that you just had and say, well, and Shelley, I'll let you deal with this one. They mostly asked questions, you know. we're sort of used to watching, you know, point and counterpoint kinds of arguments. It sounded like mainly they were asking questions rather than giving us answers. Shelley, respond to that.
Well, sometimes I say to my students, in fact, I said this at the start of the semester for a class I'm teaching now, it takes 10 seconds to ask the question, but it can take hours, or if not longer, to actually work out an answer. The answers get very complicated. If we were to take a single philosophical question or a single topic within contemporary, you know, current events that have a philosophical side to it, and you gave us the wherewithal to talk about it not in, you know, 1-minute answers or even 5-minute answers, but gave us a half hour to bandy it about, different answers would emerge. It's not that the three of us would agree. That's not especially likely. But at least different types of answers, and we'd have a sense of what are the strengths and weaknesses of the different positions, and it that takes time.
Yeah, go ahead, Michael.
I just wanted to add that it's also important to be able to find out which question we should be asking. I mean, that's part of what we were doing there, is we were trying to figure out, well, which is the right question to start with? And that's something that philosophers since Socrates, right, have been particularly interested and in some cases very adept at doing.
I was just going to add that I think that one thing that political theorists do often is say, hey, we've been asking this set of questions, and actually what's missing is this whole other realm of questions.
Right.
And so I think that opening a new kind of dialogue or a new perspective is actually one of the most important things that theory or philosophy can offer.
So let's take something that does get argued about all the time by just around dinner tables and on the news and whatever, but has a huge philosophical underpinning. At least I would assume that it does. Questions of abortion, and we can even throw in there stem cell research. So if you turn on – I mean, I used to almost never allow abortion to be discussed on my old talk show for 16 years because people just staked out territory, right? A group of people said it was essentially murder. Another group of people talked about a woman's right to control her own medical destiny. Then there were wussies like me who would get in the middle and say safe, legal, and rare. And that was sort of about it. And the ball rarely advanced down the field or moved in any direction whatsoever. So, Shelley, I'll start with you. Can philosophers set this up in a different way? In the ways that Lita and Michael were just saying, can they make sure that a different set of questions get asked so that there's something more to talk about?
Sure. So most of the discussion in the public sphere about abortion turns on the question, when does human life begin? That's probably not the way that a philosopher would pose the question, but we have a feel for it. Does the fetus, does the developing child have the same rights that you and I have? And the thought is that the assumption is if the answer to that is yes, then abortion is murder, hence unjustified. If the answer to that is no, then abortion is not murder, and of course abortion should be allowed. The philosopher Judy Jarvis Thompson, who teaches at MIT or retired recently from MIT, made a wonderful contribution to the philosophical discussion of abortion about 40-odd years ago when she offered an analogy involving a violinist. It'll take me a moment to spell the analogy out, but at least you can see how it raises an interesting issue that we might not have thought about otherwise. So in the quick version of the example, you wake up, you've been kidnapped, and you're now in a hospital room where you are connected through a series of tubes to somebody at the other end of the room. In Thompson's example, it's a famous violinist. And he has the hospital director explains to you that the violinist, has a medical disease. His kidneys can't handle it, the toxins. But you have the right type, and so your kidney is cleaning the toxins out at no risk to yourself whatsoever. If you disconnect the tubes, the violinist dies. If you stay connected, eventually the toxins will be cleared, and the violinist can be disconnected from you and walk away healthy and free and alive. Now, the only catch is you've got to stay connected to the violinist for 9 months. And what Thompson thought we would think, that is to say, what most people reacting to this case say is, well, it would be nice of you to stay connected to the violinist, but you're not obliged to stay connected to the violinist. And the analogy obviously is supposed to be to what's going on in pregnancy, where you're connected to somebody. And even if the violinist presumably has the same rights you and I have, and yet for all that, if you disconnect it, you will be killing the violinist. The violinist ends up dead. And yet for all that, if we think that's permissible, and that is what's permissible, it shows that the abortion debate's far more complicated than we might have earlier realized. Even if the fetus does have rights, even if human life does start at conception, it doesn't follow that abortion is unjustified. So there's an example where philosophers have made a contribution to the philosophical understanding, the moral understanding of the underlying issues, but it hasn't been taken up very much in the public domain at all.
I would say that if it were an accordionist, most people would disconnect the tubes right away. But so you might have even loaded the dice a little bit by making it a violinist. So that's what's sometimes called a thought experiment. Michael Lynch, is that a useful to you thought experiment or an interesting one?
Well, I think it is an interesting one. It's certainly a very famous one. I've always felt that that particular thought experiment does have both the great aspect of a thought experiment, which is it abstracts from certain details and gets us to focus on the things that the author of the thought experiment thinks is salient. Judy's idea of focusing on the idea that we could walk away from this particular case. I think it also tends to, as lots of people pointed out, underplay the sort of really intimate relationship that a woman has to her unborn child. So I think that's complicated, that real intimate relationship. Whatever your views on abortion can, you know, once you throw that in, I think that all the emotional aspects that go with that can really affect your reaction to the thought experiment. So, and that's a classic problem with that thought experiment. But I think what Shelley's bringing out nicely is that this is the sort of, you know, this is the sort of conceptual engineering that philosophers can do. We can try to lay out what are the connections between different concepts and our reactions to concepts. And let's map those out. And then, you know, maybe we can later do some conceptual archaeology, sort of figure out why we got to this way of looking at the issue rather than some other way.
And Lita, you may have some specific place you want to go with this, and I want to hear that. But let me just also just throw one other little monkey wrench into there, almost maybe literally a monkey wrench. So, I mean, just to sort of illustrate how many different ways philosophy has to lay out one problem. So Peter Singer, who might be the only philosopher better known than Martha Nussbaum, would probably say something like, I'm not that interested in that analogy because the violinist has interests, right? The violinist is a fully formed adult violinist who has preferences and interests and is capable, if this procedure works well, of agency on his or her own behalf. There's a whole bunch of ways ways in which this violinist isn't very much like a fetus. A fetus just doesn't have interests in the broadest and most complex meaning of that word. And that really, as far as Singer is concerned, a chimpanzee has more interests. An adult chimpanzee has more interests than a fetus, that it probably its rights should be talked about in a more elaborate way than the rights of a fetus would be talked about, which is, once again, another example of how many different places philosophy can go with a question like this. But you were going to go someplace else as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think that that thought experiment shows perhaps one of the dangers of turning to philosophy to examine political problems, which Michael started to gesture at, which is that it kind of evacuates all the power relations, all of the concrete experience out of the abortion debate, and encourages us to look away from what that debate, if we can call it that, is doing on the ground to people, and instead encourages us to think in the abstract. Anyone could offer this kind of, you know, analysis, but, you know, if we look at what anti-abortion people are doing on the ground, what they're doing is attempting to control women's bodies, and that, you know, is evacuated from that thought experiment. So sometimes philosophy, I think, can also lead us astray or perhaps away from where we need to go.
Although then that becomes let me just stay with you for a second, Lita, and then we have to go to break. But so that becomes like one of the questions that I started to have as I was preparing for this show is, at what point is something philosophy, and at what point is some or philosophical inquiry, and at what point is something just your opinion? Like, I have opinions about stuff, you know. What elevates something to the level of philosophical inquiry and relegates something else to just your opinion, man?
I think that's a really good question, and I imagine that Michael and Shelley both have views on that. You know, I think that historically philosophy has been an exercise of contemplation that's solitary, that you write about and perhaps, you know, discuss with a few others, you know, and it's supposed to be based in justification and reason versus, you know, some people say opinions in the public realm are more based in the passions. I would probably take issue with that division, but I think that's a classical way to understand philosophy. But I would defer, you know, I'm a political theorist. I would defer to the philosophers on the call.
Michael seems to be ready to be deferred to.
So what I'd say is, look, they're really, I mean, I don't know. I don't see a really huge difference between philosophy and opinion in any sort of deep sense. What I see is that some opinions can be well argued for and justified and come out of a place of contemplation, and others can, you know, be shooting from the hip. And I think that that's the relevant difference. I mean, there is a difference between philosophical questions, I think, and other sorts of questions. Mm. I mean, not everybody thinks that either. And maybe philosophical questions grade into various other questions. You know, maybe there's a fuzzy dividing line between philosophy and political science at some point, and philosophy and science. I think that's probably true. But, you know, philosophical questions have certain hallmarks. Often they have this sort of hallmark of, to me, of questions that on the one hand we feel compelled to answer, questions about what is justice, what is truth, what is the meaning of life. And yet at the very same time, we see that they're extremely paradoxical. They're very, very difficult to get our mind around. They have this sort of both aspect that pulls us towards them and pulls us away from them. And to me, that's the sort of hallmark of philosophical questions. And philosophical questions, I think, are the things that philosophers think about. But guess what? Everybody thinks about them.
Yes, I'd want to emphasize the point that Michael made initially, which is that it's not that your opinions are about a different subject matter than the sorts of things philosophers are thinking about. The question is just where on the range of the continuum from having arguments for your opinions versus not having arguments do you fall? Have you thought about the assumptions behind your opinions? Have you examined the opinions and asked, are you prepared to apply them in other areas where you might not have thought about their implications? That's the sort of thing a philosopher does professionally, as yes. it were, and that's what differentiates mere opinion from a philosophical argument.
Yeah, I will say that one of the more impressive things from this podcast that we were on was that Shelley undertook a conversation with Liev Leibowitz, who's also on the podcast, about gun control. And Liev, like a lot of people, can imagine situations where it would be useful for him to have a gun or for somebody else to have a gun. And Shelley, I thought you sort of framed that in a different way, in a much larger way, about sort of what ultimately is our goal in terms of either having or not having that. What do we really want? And to me, that might be the difference between opinion and philosophy. I'll tell you what, let's take a quick break here. We'll come back. We have so much more to talk about in so little time. All right, we're back. Welcome to Ask a Philosopher, which is so far not an ongoing show. It's just one episode of this show. But, you know, I can see it. I can see the T-shirts, the merch, the merchandising. I can see it all, really. And
leave
so,
the thinking to us.
That's right. Oh, I like that. I like that. Could you do Bogart a little bit? I'll do the thinking for both of us. All right, Shelley Kagan is going to do the thinking for all of us. He's the Clark Professor of Philosophy at Yale University and the author of Death, a book examining the philosophical questions that arise when we confront mortality. Michael Lynch is Professor of Philosophy at UConn. He's the author of In Praise of Reason, Why Reason and Reason Giving Matters. And Lita Maxwell, Associate Professor of Political Science, a teacher of political philosophy at Trinity, and she's the author of Public Trials, Burke, Zola, Arendt, and the Politics of Lost Causes. And what we're kind of doing is just sort of saying, wow, is philosophy should be useful to us in some of these thorny questions that we tackle in the public sphere. And so, you know, why don't we know more about philosophy? Why don't we come at questions like this in a more philosophical manner? What can philosophers offer us in terms of tools for talking about these things? I've got a few more of these examples, many of which you're quite familiar with. But I feel like I would be remiss if I didn't say that right now, I'm sure all of you in the environments in which you work are struggling with or watching colleagues and students struggle with essentially philosophical questions. Shelley's campus of Yale has been convulsed recently with what is basically a philosophical question, right? A question of to what degree is academic exploration consistent with or inimical to the desire of various people to have a safe space in which they're not assaulted by ideas, assertions, and images that they find disturbing. So on the one hand, you know, you have Kingman Brewster, when he was president of Yale, talked about the risks of real freedom. He said universities should be safe havens where ruthless examination of realities will not be distorted by the aim to please or inhibited by risk of displeasure, that basically it's a place to go and ask hard questions and take chances and kind of let the chips fall where they may, at least to a certain degree. That seems to be bumping up against a climate of people who feel as though, well, no, there are really things that are not worth seeing if they hurt or offend or disrupt the comfort and the safeness of people who've come to a university to study. So, Shelley, since it's your university, I was trying to find who had a Twitter account and who didn't. So I typed Shelley Kagan into Twitter, and what I got was people tweeting saying, "I don't know what Shelley Kagan thinks about this whole situation down at Yale." So it's your campus. So far, you haven't been appointed philosopher king there yet, although I think Ted Cruz is doing everything he can on your behalf. But so, I mean, this is a fundamentally a philosophical argument. It may be other things as well, but it is that, right?
That's right. I mean, you've got competing values here. Obviously, people have a right to be safe in a literal sense, to be protected from acts of violence. It's a harder question of whether or not you've got a right not to be offended. And the difficulty is that we also believe in the value of free speech, to kind of just give it a familiar name. And the university in particular is known as, its purpose is to inquire and to try out new ideas. And it's a common enough thought that unless we have a freedom to try out ideas that others will find not just false, but troubling, problematic, offensive, then we're not going to be able to fulfill our purpose. At the same time, we don't want to be going around hurting one another, and finding the right balance is both a practical difficulty and it's just one more philosophical issue about what's the right balance between these potentially competing values.
So, Alita, another thing that I see in this question is something that you talked about a little bit earlier in our conversation vis-a-vis nation states, and that is people identifying themselves as communities. In this case, it's sometimes it's people on campus who say, well, we're a community, and you know what? We don't really want Christine Lagarde, the president of the World Bank, to give our commencement address, or Condoleezza Rice. We're a community. We don't really feel like listening to that. And as a community, we are capable of acting together to push away ideas that we find noxious. And that is bumping up against some of the things that Shelley's talking about, which is that inquiry means inquiry into multiple sides of any question.
Yeah. So this is a really hard question, I think. And I guess I would say two things. First thing is that in the Yale example, which I want to go back to before talking about people, you know, wanting Christine Lagarde not to come, you know, I think that it is philosophical. One could see it that way. But you could also see it as really not a philosophical problem, that it's about students feeling like they're on a racist campus. And then how do they respond? And that our, you know, many of our languages of protest are kind of worn out. And they've found this language of safety that seems to animate for them what the problem is. And so I think that there are problems with the language of safety. But I feel like there has to be a way for us to perhaps be in solidarity with the anti-racism that they're advocating while finding a way to raise questions about the safe space discourse. And that safe space discourse is what you're talking about in terms of, like, I don't want to hear Christine Lagarde. I don't want to hear I'm forgetting the other people.
Condoleezza Rice,
yeah. You know, that they're not welcome on this campus. And I think that we have to figure out ways to interrogate that and say, you know, that might be a way of actually excluding, right, which is not what we want to be doing with creating a safe space. We're trying to not exclude, but actually that discourse itself becomes exclusive. But still being, you know, figuring out what's happening in those struggles and what it is, what the principles are that are animating them.
Although, Michael, I think in some ways this is a philosophical question. The whole thing's a philosophical question. And at Yale, one of the flashpoints at Yale was this email sent out by the assistant master of Silliman College, who was essentially saying, well, I mean, I'm going to use my analogy, not hers, that what you don't want to do in any kind of environment where people are thinking and talking and learning together is kind of do what we did with hand sanitizers and antibiotics, which is purify it to the extent that, in fact, you know, we begin to lose our ability to fight off irresponsible ideas and bad ideas because we never encounter them. And in some ways, just the way that microbes got stronger, they went away and got stronger and more resistant. You know, I mean, if you make things too clean and too sterile, you don't have the biome anymore to work on, against some of the things that you find noxious or virulent or toxic. And that, you know, that all kinds of people from Oliver Wendell Holmes to John Milton have said, no, you put truth out there on the field with falsehood, and truth will ultimately prevail. So good things will prevail. Truth will prevail. And it's better that it prevail in that environment where it's bumping up against the risk of irresponsibility and harm.
You know, I have a lot of sympathy for that, Colin. But because I'm a philosopher, let me be the devil's advocate,
right,
as it were, and point out that I think you're right, too, that this is a philosophical question. I think it's also right to say that it's a question that has more than a philosophical dimension, obviously. It's a political, straightforward political question, we might say, about, you know, if you want to say, describe that as a question of how we should set up our political structures, including where that includes our university structures. But look, here's the point that I think sometimes gets lost here. Right now, what you just made the case for, Colin, was this way of thinking about inquiry where we want to allow freedom of inquiry. We want to open up inquiry so that we can find the truth. And that is absolutely important to me. On the other hand, philosophers from Foucault to more recently Miranda Fricker, a British philosopher, have been emphasizing that we also need to, as we shape and understand inquiry, we need to be wary of the fact that there are factors out in society that can inhibit inquiry, that can inhibit the formation of knowledge, that can actually lead people to start regarding each other as not full knowers, that people who look like me, middle-aged white guy, can have a certain status in inquiry that another person from a more in a minority status, for example, in our particular culture or context, might be framed as not having the sort of status of as a rational inquirer that I have. Now, that you might think, well, that's a long way to go from that question to the question of, you know, dude, should this guy have sent this email or not? And you're right, it is sort of a long way to go, but there is an actual path here. The question that we're worried about in part is this question of, how do we structure inquiry on a college campus or in a scientific lab such that we're both free to pursue truth but also free from being those social factors that can actually inhibit indirectly some people's participation in that process.
Yeah. See, I graduated before Foucault entered into this, so I don't know anything about that. I'm inoculated or something. All right. So
Foucault, there are some ways in which that's a good thing.
Yeah, I know. There's like a lot of time was saved in my life so I could watch football. All right. So let's take a quick break here. Let's come back. We'll have at least time for one more thing. I think I want to talk to the philosophers about torture. This has become a very interesting question for the U.S., and it's just perfect for philosophers. Not that they like to torture people.
He's a miniature philosopher. He writes essays on Voltaire.
You know, this feels like an awful lot of talk about philosophy, so just to keep things in balance, here's a brief discussion of welding.
What did you do?
Welder.
Settling, MIG, TIG?
Any of it. If it can be welded, I can weld it.
Cast iron?
Yeah.
I don't mean braze.
I didn't say braze.
Pop metal.
What did I say?
So much better. Today's show was produced by Josh Nalea and me, Kyone Wolf. Greg Hill appeared in the intro and tweets for us at WNPR Colin. Our interns are Nate Gagnon and Zachary LaSala. The part of Bill Curry was played by Bertrand Russell. For show pages, articles, and details about the name change of Here and Now to Being and Nothingness, go to our website, WNPR.org/Colin. On tomorrow's show, the brave new world of modern prosthetics. And now, back to Colin.
All right. So, yeah, so we're having a lot of fun here with Ask a Philosopher. And so if you want Shelley and Michael and Lita to have even more adventures in their own podcast and spinoff TV show, just email me afterwards, Colin, C-O-L-I-N, at WNPR.org. We'd love to hear more about how you processed this show. Or you can tweet at us at WNPR Colin. So Shelley Kagan, Michael Lynch, Lita Maxwell, all here. This is sort of something that I, in my lifetime, I didn't think that I would wind up in conversations about, which is the potential utility slash, well, I'm making morality is not a word I would be comfortable with, of torture. But we've had it in this century. We've had this conversation. And we've had it in movies like Zero Dark Thirty, where it's suggested that that something that looks very much like torture to me would be useful, maybe was useful in obtaining information about the whereabouts of Osama bin Laden. And we have it sort of constantly in the – it's usually posed to us, Shelley, and I'll sort of kick this off with you, in the ticking bomb problem, right? There's a bomb somewhere. You've got somebody in custody who knows something about the bomb. You might be able to save lives, but you have to be willing to torture this person. So as a thought experiment, first of all, is that a useful way to approach something as laden as the question of our government torturing anybody?
Well, I think it's one thing that we need to be thinking about. I mean, this brings us back to a point that Lita made earlier, that we can't merely think about these questions from an abstract perspective. I mean, facts matter. One fact, obviously, that matters is, does torture work or not? Are you likely to learn anything in the ticking bomb scenario that's going to genuinely be useful to you or not? So that's an empirical question, and I have to just confess that as a philosopher, I don't have any special expertise. But let's just suppose that it did work. That is to say, we had some reason to believe that torture could yield information. There still is the question, which I will unabashedly call a moral question, is torture ever justified, including in circumstances like this? And to have an informed view about that, you need to embed your answer, it seems to me, in a larger set of moral in a larger bit of moral theorizing. Do we take the kind of moral approach where we say, as long as the results are overall good, then no matter what we do, that's justified? That's one kind of approach to ethics. Or do we take an approach that says certain sorts of actions are morally off the table, no matter what the results might be? The empirical side of the question is an important one, but the moral side of the question has to be addressed as well. And we can't just settle ourselves, be satisfied with the knee-jerk reaction, oh, torture, that's okay, or no, torture, that's not okay. We need to move to the larger theoretical questions within moral philosophy.
I'm sure both of you have. I can tell Michael's got a place he wants to go with this. But, Lita, I'm going to start with you just to go back to one of the places that we that we went before, which is that whole question of nation states. So one argument that could be made is, you know, if the U.S. demonstrates in one way or another through voting, through polling, whatever, if the U.S. population says, yes, you know what, we actually are very comfortable with that. We think it's necessary. We think it's necessary for our safety. We want our leaders. We want our military people. We want our intelligence community to be authorized under certain circumstances to torture somebody else if it's going to keep a large group of people safer. It's kind of the famous trolley experiment in a way. So what about that? Is that meaningful? Is it meaningful for the preponderance of a society to say, well, screw it, we want to do it anyway?
I mean, you're raising the question of, right, should democracy, should citizens have, in a sense, unfettered control, right, over their society? Or should we respect laws and constitutions, right, that we have created to, in a sense, restrain ourselves in such instances? And I would say, I mean, I don't know what the poll numbers are or how people would vote on such a case. But for me, in a way, what's more interesting about the torture case that we've seen is the way in which law was used to defend it. In legal language was, in a sense, you know, perverted, I would say, to justify torture. And in a sense, accustomed citizens to thinking of it as something that was possible and legal. So I think, you know, if we think about what citizens want to do, we also have to think about the kinds of tools that were used by an administration to shape public opinion, to think that torture could be something legal and normatively okay. And I think that that is really a problem, as David Cole, among others, has argued in great detail.
All right, Michael, take it anywhere you want.
So I think that one of the things that Lita brings out, and I think Shelley as well, is that there that we could think of, you know, when we think about the ticking bomb question, we can think of it as really – it's a very blunt instrument to get at the complexities of this particular problem. And one reason for that is, as Lita was just pointing out, there's really a distinction between the question of what's the policy or rule or moral rule, if you want to, that we should take as informing our policy in this question on the question of torture, and whether in a particular instance it might be, let's say, justified on utilitarian or consequentialist grounds. Funny to say this in front of Shelley Kagan, who's very famous for writing on these sorts of things. Whether a particular act or instance is of torture might have good consequences, like getting this information. So I always sort of think that, look, you know, the policy question is really the question that we should be interested in, because the ticking time bomb scenario doesn't come around very often outside of television. So what it seems to me we should be thinking about is, in general, should we be informing our policy with a rule or principle, a moral principle that says it's okay to torture? It seems to me we might think that there might be cases where it's perfectly it turns out it would have been a good thing to torture the person in that particular instance, but still think that we should hold by this principle as a matter of general rule, because as a general fact, abiding by the principle that, well, you know, make up your mind at the time, let's not really, or it's okay, and let's embody it and with law, which is even worse, it's okay to torture and pervert our legal principles into justifying torture, that can lead to really bad effects for society in the long run. So that's one way of thinking about it.
We're almost out of time. If I were a better Wittgensteinian, I probably could say that we need to have a whole separate conversation about the word torture and what it applies to and what it means.
Yes.
And how – to what degree we've defined a situation. I mean, there's certainly people on the other side of this question from where all four of us, I think, sit, who would say, well, wait a minute. What are you calling torture? Because there's a whole bunch of things that we sometimes think that we need to do that we don't think is torture. We call them stress positions. We call it waterboarding. We call it lots of different things. But we don't call it torture. And the minute you call it torture, you've begun, in fact, to define this question in – you know, in a way that's premature. Let's have the linguistic conversation too.
And that's, of course, just the sort of thing philosophers love to do. We like to do conceptual analysis and
exactly.
Ask just what is the very idea of torture, precisely because until we get clearer on that, we're not really going to be well positioned to answer is it ever legitimate or not.
All right. We have to stop now, although really these adventures should absolutely continue. So thanks for playing Ask a Philosopher, Shelley Kagan, Clark Professor of Philosophy at Yale, Michael Lynch, Professor of Philosophy at UConn, Lita Maxwell is Associate Professor of Political Science, Teacher of Political Philosophy at Trinity College in Hartford. If you just love to Ask a Philosopher, send me, they're all kind of blanching whenever I say this. But send me an email at Colin. It's colin@wnpr.org. Tell us what you think. Maybe we can get them all back together again. Maybe they can get their own podcast. They probably won't even remember me. when I'm lying in the street and they walk by me, superstars that they will be.
Hey, girl. Did it hurt?
Ugh. Did what hurt?
When you fell from heaven.
Okay, nice try with the falling from heaven bit, but God is dead, and we killed him.
I think, therefore, I am not going home with you.